I found that from time to time, people come along wanting to learn to meditate. And as you know, we set great store here by the Four Noble Truths, all of them, including the Third Noble Truth, that there is such a thing as enlightenment, that it's not some fantasy, it's not superstition, it's something real and attainable. And sometimes, and I've had it quite a few times, that the person I'm talking to will sort of say, oh, no, no, it's okay, I'm not really after enlightenment, but, you know, I just want to be, you know, feel more peaceful inside. Okay. Other people say, oh, no, I don't want enlightenment, I just want, I just want freedom from anxiety. Okay. Other people sort of say, oh, it's not enlightenment I want really so much, it's just that sense of being incomplete, I'd really like that not to be there, and that's what's driving me. And for another, it might be, oh, it's not enlightenment I want, it's just like life always seems to be happening somewhere else, and I want to be there rather than perennially here waiting for things to happen. And in all, with the greatest respect, I find in all cases I'm sort of going, well, yeah, that's all. You do want to be enlightened, then. Because enlightenment is all those things. It is peace of mind. It is freedom from anxiety and worries. It's understanding life in a very intimate and complete way. It is the discovery that life is actually happening right now to you at this moment, and it isn't happening anywhere better elsewhere. So it really is. It really seems to me, anyway, to underlie what everyone's looking for, that they're looking for this elusive peace and happiness. And the Buddha's teaching is very definitely geared towards helping us to realise it. Sometimes I think that the problem with the idea of nibbana or nirvana is it's widely understood or called, is that it has such religious connotations that the Buddha did not originate a religion. That's not what he was about. But subsequent to his discovery of Nibbana and being able to so eloquently develop a training whereby anyone could find it for themselves, that was, as it were, taken, and gradually what formed out of that was what we know as the religious Buddhism. And in our culture, at this time, religious ideas, religious ideologies are somewhat distrusted, shall we say. It's a very materially driven, rational, scientific age that we're living in. And so I think that sometimes the idea of nirvana, what tends to happen with religious ritual and religious observance, I think we can say, is that we tend to elevate things through our willingness to bow before these ideas, these concepts. We elevate them in our minds, and the outcome of that can be that it appears as though they're no longer attainable, that we're not worthy, we're too little, too small, too insignificant to possibly realise something as quite as amazing as Buddhahood, to actually realise what the Buddha realised, because the Buddha himself is raised up to be sort of like a godlike figure. And can you see what I mean? So we elevate, and so it takes it out of the realms of possibility, which is such a shame. And yet, underlying it, underlying all our activities in life, is this desire, this hidden story that underlies everything, this wanting to be free, wanting to find peace, wanting to find happiness, wanting to find completion in some way. The Buddha was a man. Yeah, I've got it written here, so it must be true. The Buddha was a man. He was flesh and blood. He was born a prince, but that was his karma. That was his. That was what he was due. He was born into that life because that life would give him the best opportunities to learn the things he had to learn in order to be free of suffering. So he wasn't some super being. I mean, he was a super being. He was an amazing man. but he was flesh and blood like us. And I think it's really useful to remember that, because sometimes we can fall into the trap of really believing that we're somehow not worthy of enlightenment ourselves, even though it is actually our true nature. So it's not actually something completely beyond the realms of possibility. It's actually something intimate, something that we're very actually is with us all the time. It's just that we ignore it. You don't have to be clever in order to become enlightened. In actual fact, being clever can sometimes be a really major obstacle. I'm minded here of the story of Chulapandika. Do people know the story of Chulapandika in the Pali Canon? That's such a wonderful story. Chulapandika, he and his brother Mahapandika were siblings, and they both joined the order together. His brother became enlightened very quickly, but Chulapandika, how might we say this, he wasn't the brightest star in the firmament, if I can put it like that. He was a bit thick, and he couldn't even remember a four-line verse that he'd been given to recite. He'd remember one line, and he'd try to remember the next line, and the first line would disappear. So he wasn't the brightest spark, and he got sort of expelled by his brother from the order, and the Buddha found out about it, and he said, "Well, I'm not having this." So he went to Chulapandika and he said, "Look, nobody gets expelled from my order because they can't remember verse, because that's got nothing to do with it." So the Buddha gave Chulapandika a silk cloth, and he said to Chulapandika, "Rub on this cloth, and as you're rubbing on the cloth, tell yourself again and again, the cloth is getting clean, the cloth is getting clean." So Chulapandika could do that. So he did that for a while, and he began to notice the oil from his fingers was coming off and grubbing up the cloth. Yeah. So as he was even saying, "The cloth is getting clean, the cloth is getting clean," the cloth was actually getting dirtier and dirtier. And in that moment, he realized enlightenment. You don't have to be clever, but you do have to develop a certain intelligence, which obviously Chulapandika had. The ability to examine life clearly and closely. You don't have to be intellectual, but you do have to develop a certain intelligence, the ability to look clearly at what's going on in your experience. Yes. Well, I don't want to sound hard on the intellectuals, but accumulating more and more knowledge does not set you free. It doesn't free you from dukkha. I have known many people who have been what you would call technically quite clever, and they have been able to absorb the teaching very quickly. They are, in that sense, very, very bright. They can make sense to a certain extent of the Buddha's higher teaching, the Abhidhamma. And yet, in meditation interviews, I ask them, "How's the meditation going?" And often they will just start telling you what they know intellectually. Or if they do describe the meditation is actually no better than anybody else's. They still fall asleep, they still fantasize, they still think about the teaching a lot. And so they're actually no further on than anybody else. So it's a bit of a false economy, intellectual understanding. It can actually become an obstacle if the person doesn't realize that it's just an intellectual grasp and think that it means that they've got some deep insight. Intellectual knowledge and wisdom are two different things. Chulapandika had wisdom, but he wasn't an intellectual great by any means. Now, the reason I'm saying that is because people do often put themselves down, thinking that somehow that their struggle to grasp all the concepts involved in the Buddha's teaching somehow disallows them from achieving their heart's desire, which is to be free of suffering, and that's just simply not the case. There's no need to compare, you see. I watched a program recently on a Kenyan elephant shrew. A Kenyan elephant shrew, about that big, an inch long. But relative to its size, its speed makes it the quickest animal on the planet. And it has this, it creates this track which it's constantly cleaning through the undergrowth. And as long as it can zip up and down that track, it's fine, it knows what it's doing. But if anything happens, like for instance, elephant dung falling on the track and it can't go up and down the track, it's stuffed. So what I mean by that is that on the one end of the scale you've got a Kenyan elephant shrew, and at the other end of the scale you've got an entirely enlightened Buddha, historical Buddha. So where on that scale would you place yourself? And does it really matter? You don't have to compare. The idea is that we're here to learn lessons about how life works. Now, you know, in Buddhism we have this concept of rebirth. This is another one of these areas where people get a little bit sceptical, a little bit, oh, that's a bit superstitious, isn't it? You don't believe in all that sort of stuff. Indeed, in the question and answer session we had at the end of last season, I had reason to mention in passing rebirth with regard to another matter that I was talking about. And I noticed this subtle, it wasn't almost not physical at all, but there was this, amongst you, the community as gathered on that evening, there was just like this slight tensing up, slight withdrawal. So I was like, oh, he's mentioned rebirth. I didn't think we were going to mention rebirth. I'm going to do a rebirth special lecture soon, honestly. Get you quaking in your chairs. It's such a shame that people, when people feel a little bit closed to the idea of rebirth, because it's so liberating. It's so wonderfully liberating to think that perhaps we've been decanted into this life. From whence we came, nobody knows, but we find ourselves here. And that we've only got 60, 70, 80, 90 years on the planet. And we're confronted with all these issues and these difficulties and these problems to solve. And whether we're Buddhist meditators or not is irrelevant. And the idea that perhaps, just perhaps, that it's a really good idea that we're here with the faculties developed as they are, whether your faculties are well developed or not so well developed, but they are as they are, and that you actually have the perfect situation as your life is right now to learn the lessons you need to learn in order to free yourself from suffering. Well, to my mind, everyone obviously, you know, it's just, we would like the idea of people keeping an open mind here, of course, but to my mind that just seems like wonderful. So it's only a brief period of time in the grand scheme of things, 60, 70, 80 years, in order to stand here on this interface between life as it presents itself and then having to learn about how you respond and what kind of ways you respond. That's certainly the Buddhist take on why we're here, and so there are things to learn. I was very saddened actually to hear that an actor that I always really liked died at the weekend of a heroin overdose. American actor, won an Oscar, he was well regarded in the acting fraternity, well respected, and of course there are tremendous testimonials, and people remembered him and had only good things to say about him, and it was all geared around him as an actor. Of course, he was a tremendously successful actor. And I was thinking, but there's this underlying life, there's this underlying aspect to life that, of course, I wouldn't expect them to notice or to talk about. But Yeah, he was a great actor. But underlying that, there was this sense of this man who was trying to come to terms with a long-standing addiction, who was using chemical stimulation of one kind or another as a way to try and find peace and happiness. So below the story that everyone was talking about, for me as a Buddhist, there was this other story, this underlying story of somebody wanting to find peace and happiness, and was trying it through that particular method. And the beautiful thing about rebirth is, of course, he gets another go. He's allowed to make mistakes. Even to that degree, you're allowed to make mistakes. So you get this wonderful sense of compassion beginning to emerge with a view of rebirth, not only towards other people, but also to oneself. Which is to say, you're at liberty, you are free to experiment with life. Now, I don't think we should all go out taking drugs. That's not what I'm saying. I think it's a good idea to keep precepts. I think this is an example of why. It's a very good idea. Perhaps he chalks that one off to experience, but perhaps he has to come into another life, and the resultants of the behaviour in this life will have a bearing on the kind of circumstances he finds himself in that future life. They might not be better, is what I'm saying. So it pays to keep precepts, because precepts are about lessening self-concern, they're about practicing a certain restraint and a certain level of renunciation. Right, so it might not be drugs, but people have issues with drink. People have issues with food. People have issues with spending too long surfing the net. There are things for all of us to learn, and that's the point. Is that it's life as it unfolds is giving us the opportunity to learn. But the thing is, what is it we've got to learn about? The Buddha summed up his entire teaching in what are called the Four Noble Truths. I hope you're all aware of what the Four Noble Truths are, because it's pretty essential that you understand that. Life is suffering. The cause of suffering is craving, a passionate desire for life to be different than it is. There is a cessation of suffering. It's real. It's attainable by anybody. And there is a way to actually free yourself from the craving that causes the suffering. And that the Buddha enshrined in what's called the Noble Eightfold Path. So what is it we're trying to learn about in all these different life situations that we're presented with? We're learning about suffering, and we're learning about what causes the suffering. Now, there's one really important aspect to this that needs to be borne in mind. That the things that we're presented with are suffering, but they're not the cause of suffering. So external events are not the cause of our suffering. The cause of our suffering is craving, which is an internal thing. It's an internal matter. And that's important, because it's a bit like you've got a cold and you sneeze and your nose runs and you've got a cough. They're all just symptoms, aren't they? They're not the cause of the problem, they're just the symptoms of the result of having the problem. It results in those kinds of manifestations. When we see the world around us and we interact with the world, we find it unsatisfactory. We find that it doesn't live up to our expectations. We get let down. Things that we'd like to happen don't happen, and if they do happen, we realise that they weren't what we wanted anyway. And so the thing we have to learn is that there's nothing you can do about the external situation, that it is the way it is. It is dukkha, it is suffering. I mean, even if it's really nice things that happen, they're not going to last, are they? not going to be forever. So part of the journey, the real journey of life, it seems to me anyway, is in people being brought face to face with the realities of life and then choosing to respond in certain ways and finding out through the actual performance of that whether or not it was a good idea or not. So what I'm trying to get at is that ultimately people start to discover that no matter how much they try to manipulate the externals, no matter how hard they try, it always ends up that they still feel dissatisfied, there's still the fear, there's still the anxiety, there's still the sense of life happening somewhere else and me being here waiting for it to happen. So you go around the track, you try something, you come back and you find out that it didn't give you ultimately what you wanted. Right? Giving you a few kicks on the way. I'm not saying, you know, it doesn't, but those things can't be relied upon. And gradually, somebody, through that process, begins to approach the idea that maybe it's something that I'm doing. Maybe it's not so much that the world is wrong, but maybe it's just my understanding of it, which is faulty, that needs to be corrected. Do you see where this is going? So it's beginning to approach the idea that actually it is my responses that need to be looked at. The things that you're presented with, the life that you have been given, in inverted commas, although it's only ultimately your own actions previously that brought you to this stage of life and where you are with the things you have around you and the issues you have in your life. It's not the issues themselves, which is the problem. So just in Buddhism we say it's just the resultant. Those are just the resultants of your past actions. It's about the interface. It's about where you are now and what you do in response. Your journey, everyone's journey, is absolutely unique. Again, this is what I mean when I say there's no need to compare. You've actually got something far richer in your life right now than you can ever have through comparing with somebody else and saying, well, if I had it like that, I would be in a better place. If I had a little bit more nous, I would be in a better place. If I was a bit taller, you know, if I got my teeth fixed, whatever it is, that, you know, you suddenly realise that your journey is unique to you. It's perfect for you. It's bringing you the lessons that you need to start to be able to look at your responses. So it's really helpful to have something like the Buddha's teaching, which first of all informs us of this. It then gives us a framework whereby we can understand what's this underlying story of what's going on, and we can begin to apply it. Keeping precepts is a perfect example. Being moderate in eating food. Anything that is trying to help us to a more balanced place, to be there in the middle a little bit more and less extreme, is forcing us to confront our responses to life. Saying something as simple as moderating food intake, perhaps deciding not to eat between meals. Now, it does take a certain amount of determination. Through eating whatever we want, whenever we want, we're not hungry when we do it, so there must be another reason. Do we know what that reason is? Through choosing to restrain the excess, it begins to become clear what's driving that necessity for that extra biscuit, or wherever it might be. And you start to see that there is a discomfort. There is a sense of, maybe it's just pure habit that one's got into, but even if it's just pure habit, through the restraint of acting upon the urge, you see that urge really, really a lot more clearly. And you can see there's something that's driving it. Now, whatever it is, and it may be different for different people, but we have a generic term for it. We call it dukkha, suffering. And there is this overwhelming sense in which we want to make it different. We want to resolve this problem of suffering. We want to do something about it. We want to get rid of it. And so we act upon the urge. That is still trying to change the externals. If you restrain and you remain with that underlying sense of dis-ease, whatever it might be, there is a chance, a possibility, of seeing that sense of dissatisfaction, of unease. There's the possibility of seeing it pass away of its own accord. And you start to see, you start to get recognize the possibility that through that restraint, restraining the excess, you get to see craving, you get to see how you want to resolve this problem by doing something, and you restrain it, the dissatisfaction, the sense of dis-ease arises, takes hold, and then passes away. Now, that's got absolutely nothing to do with being clever. Because I assure you, if it was about being clever, I would be doomed. Not a clever person. Anybody can do that. You've just got to have the determination. You've just got to decide, I'm going to do it. Yeah? If that determination is true and strong, you will. Exactly the same thing happens when we meditate. Have you noticed? When you sit down to meditate and you're going to watch the rise and fall of the breath, that all these thoughts start happening. Yes, of course you have. What are those thoughts about? Perhaps I can leave it with you to go to look and see whether you're actually trying to resolve a problem with these thoughts. Whether it's daydreaming, fantasy, thoughts of sensual pleasure, whether it's irritation, ill will, whether it's worry or anxiety, whether it's doubt. At that time, you've got an issue, you've got a problem, and you want to resolve it. The key to meditation, the key to getting free of hindrances, the key of getting free of this thinking, is to choose to be determined not to resolve the issue, whatever the issue is. It's really, really helpful when you start to see that actually all your thinking is all bound up with trying to make life different, trying to resolve a problem. What is the problem? You're sitting down to meditate, you're simply sitting down to watch the breath rise and fall, and you're just going to note events as they occur and then bring the mind back. But we get caught up in something, totally hooked into something. What happens if you choose, deliberately determine, that you will not resolve that problem, whatever it is? What will happen? It's absolutely no different than choosing to restrain from grabbing the cookie jar and stuffing your face with cookies. It's the same determination. It's just on a more mental level rather than being visceral and physical. It's just a determination to restrain that excess. But it does mean that you have to live in a world where your problems are not resolved. And the art of meditation, that is the art of meditation, to sit. Where did that come from? But to sit in a world that is not finished, that is not resolved, that is not complete. It's not only that something in your external world isn't complete. It's not, I haven't paid off the credit card bill. It's also that your meditation isn't complete. Are you willing to sit with an incomplete meditation? Are you willing to sit with this whole problem of enlightenment totally unresolved? Are you willing just to sit and be with whatever comes up? It's so important. Because whenever we can't, whenever we want to resolve and get to a point of completion, that's a denial of the first noble truth, that life is suffering. And it's acting out of craving, wanting life to be different. because life will never be resolved in that way. Life is never, have you noticed? Life is never static. If life was static, it would just be a solid block of concrete and that would be. Life is dynamic, flow all the time. You can only surf life. You can't make it stop and be still. And the art of meditation, as you become more accomplished and your mindfulness increases and you become more skilled in your mindfulness, you realize that you can't just get everything to stop and just be still and be exactly as you want it to be. You have to learn to respond to the needs of the situation on its merits. And balance is dynamic. So one moment you're having to encourage the mind, another moment you're having to restrain the mind, another moment you're having to be determined and really push through. Another time that would be the worst thing to do, and you've really got to just get gentle with yourself and just be really peaceful and wait. You can't force meditation. This is no different, actually, than sticking your hand in the cookie jar or restraining from sticking your hand in the cookie jar. It's just determining that you're going to learn how to surf in meditation. Meditation is more like surfing than, I don't know, sitting on the quayside watching the surfers. It's very much about balancing as you go, rebalancing as you go. So it's never... Meditation is never stuck, it's never solid. It's always in a state of change, always in a state of flux. Gosh, how did I get there? Okay. How are we doing for time? Blimey, have I been going on that long? You should have told me. I was going to go on to insight meditation, but I've gone way too far over. I did have an analogy that I wanted to get in, and that's that. Imagine that craving is like fire, right? And fire produces smoke. And when there's a lot of smoke, you can't see what's going on. What this teaching gradually helps you to do is to stop the fires in your mind, the fires of greed, the fires of hatred. Yeah? So you gradually learn how to stop setting your mind on fire. And as you learn how to let the fires go out, so the smoke dissipates and you're able to see what's going on so much more clearly. So when we crave, we're creating fires, and the fires create smoke, which is ignorance, which is ignoring what's really taking place. The key is not to try to resolve your problems. The key is to let the problems pass away. And that's the underlying nothing like I thought this talk would come out, it doesn't matter. That's the underlying story of everyone's life, is working this out. Because when you go so far into this teaching that not only do you become somebody who knows how to put out fires when they arise, but you're somebody who got to the point where the fires don't even have the tendency to arise at all. And because there are no more fires, there's no more smoke. And because there's no more smoke, the nature of reality is obvious. Because it's not being obfuscated with this, that and the other. So it's really clear, it's really obvious. Julia Pendicker was not a clever person, but he saw life as it really was, because he could see in that moment the futility of constantly rubbing, expecting things to get clean. So he stopped. It's got nothing to do with intellect at all. He just stopped. And the moment he stopped, manipulating, controlling, completely stopped, he saw life as it really is. And that's what enlightenment is. It's just seeing life as it really, really is. And in that moment, you see that life was never ever somewhere else, happening to other people. You see that you are absolutely fundamental, you are life. You are fundamentally, you are life. And you are that dynamic flow and change, and you can't find any problem with it anywhere. So from having seen how unsatisfactory it all is, you realise, well, I can't control any of it, and totally giving up all control over it, all the ignorance goes away, and you just say, oh, it was perfect all the time. And I just didn't see it. Why? Because of all that smoke that was being created through the craving.